Welcome to the 24th United We Stand podcast of the season. My name's Andy Mitten and I'm delighted to be joined today by Ian Hawkey. Ian is a renowned journalist, European football expert, European correspondent for the Sunday Times for 12 years until recently. He lived in Barcelona, he's now living back in London. He's a Fulham fan, so that will be convenient for him. But he's also an expert on African football and he's in Rustenburg in South Africa at the moment, where the Africa Cup of Nations is taking place. He wrote a book called Feet of the Chameleon, The Story of African Football, which is excellent and is often borrowed by geeky blogging types. Welcome, Ian.
Hi, Andy. Nice to talk to you on the other side of the world.
I'd sue half the people who rob extracts from your book and don't credit you.
Yeah, I'm afraid that's pretty widespread. I think a lot of journalists who've written original stuff suffer from that. It's part of the business, unfortunately. And you know, some people are very generous with giving credit. And listen, African football needs promoting. So I guess often they're doing a little bit of a service too.
Being very generous there, considering the amount of research that you've done. We advertised that you were going to be on the podcast this week and had a quite a lukewarm response, if I'm honest. But we had a letter from South Africa, an email from South Africa saying, looking forward to listening to Ian Hawkey on the podcast. I'm an immigration officer in South Africa. Would this be the same Ian Hawkey who struggled through immigration last week because he didn't have two free pages in his passport? When I comprehended him, he said, let me in, I know far more about African football than you and any of your colleagues put together. Would that be you?
Yes, very, very generous of him not to add what I later said. I said, do you know who I am? I'm going to ring President Jacob Zuma right now. And if you're not careful, I shall be speaking to Nelson Mandela.
So you're the man. Now, Manchester United have been linked with Zaha from Crystal Palace. He obviously lives in South London, but he's got an Ivorian background. Manchester United do not tend to sign many players who they could lose to the Africa Cup of Nations. It's almost like it's becoming a policy now. Why do you think this is?
That's certainly the impression you get. And first of all, you can understand it. It is very disruptive to lose players for a month, 6 weeks of the season, in the middle of the season, in the crucial time of the season. Now, what United have achieved, among other things in the last years, is that they are very good planners of a season. Alex Ferguson takes that seriously and started doing that sort of long-term planning in terms of player fatigue and so on, possibly before other people cottoned onto it. So you can absolutely understand why he doesn't want his squad disrupted at that time of the season. It does appear almost to have become a policy. United have quite a distinguished history, as you know, of players from Africa, and they don't recruit them anymore. They do have a scouting network in Africa, quite a sophisticated one. I know some of the scouts they use, and they always talk very highly of United's rigour and scrutiny. But yes, the Nations Cup, I think, is a problem. And I think at the management level of United, they've decided that a player has to be absolutely exceptional if they're going to live with this possible leaving once every 2 years. Zaha is an interesting case. Now, as you know, he's a dual national. As you know, he's playing his options for a young man. He doesn't have to commit to a country until he's played a competitive international for one of them, which would rule him out of the other. My information is that he's veering very strongly for England. He spent his life there. And clearly, there's a commercial advantage if you're a very successful footballer to play for a big European nation as opposed to an African one, albeit a very big, successful African one. But, you know, there's a practical thing too. At the moment, if you're a striker for the Ivory Coast, it's pretty competitive there. It's hard to get in the first team. You've got Drogba. You've got a guy called Wilfried Bony who is scoring goals for fun in Holland. Aruna Kone, as you know, is doing pretty well. Jovinho, who has had an up and down time at Arsenal, is very well respected for his country and actually a very valuable player for Ivory Coast. Clearly, Drogba's not going to be around forever, so Zaha could become the figure for Ivory Coast in the future. But I think he's going for England, and there's no doubt that Manchester United will tell him that for practical reasons that would be the more sensible choice.
United have signed players who've played for African countries, even in recent years. I know going back much further, there are players like Gary Bailey, but he also played for England. Menucho, who's now doing well with Real Valladolid in Spain, he played for United only three times as a substitute. Have you met him? Have you done any stuff with him?
Yeah, absolutely. He's a big figure. I've spent quite a lot of time with the Angolans, actually. They've got a head coach who I know from years back, a Uruguayan guy. It's very interesting to see Manucho. It's very interesting because the United episode of his career, while, as you say, it's a footnote as far as United are concerned, it's a big deal for him, and it's a big deal for Angolans. Now, I don't know if you remember, it was 5 years ago that United signed Manucho, and people thought, oh, hey, this is interesting. An Angolan, that's a first. Mostly Angolan footballers, if they're going to go anywhere in Europe, they go to Portugal for language and cultural reasons. United signed this Angolan actually just before the African Nations Cup in 2008. They signed him direct from an Angolan club. Again, the scouting network had really stretched far. And at that Nations Cup in Ghana, he was good. He was really good. He was powerful. He scored a spectacular headed goal in his opening game. And everyone was thinking, hey, United have got a coup here. Then, as you know, he sort of marginalised a bit, went out on loan. But he remembers the United episode very well. It's a real badge of honour. And you see him around the Angolan camp. He's the captain of the team. He's the big guy. He swaggers around the place. The younger players really look up to him. This is the guy who played for Manchester United. Also, this is the guy who's doing quite well in the Spanish league, and he is doing well. He's had a really up and down time there. You know Spanish football well. You'll have followed his quite colourful time in Spain.
Well, when he arrived, he said that he was going to score 40 goals in a season.
That's right. Which of course everybody laughed at the time, and they laughed even more when I think his final tally was 3 or 4. Funnily enough, his account of this now is that the answer to the question of how many goals are you going to score was somehow mistranslated. Now, footballers often hide behind these bad translations, don't they? But unfortunately, he's remembered for that. But he's certainly got this aura with Angola. He's very much the figurehead of the team. And for the national team, he's been immensely successful. They play towards him. You'll remember he's a big, powerful guy. He's a proper target man. They're always sending crosses into him, and he got them to this championship. Scored a couple of spectacular headers in a playoff against Zimbabwe. And as I say, he's the United episode is very much at the top of his CV. It's his calling card, and he boasts about it.
He's doing well. He's doing well at Valladolid, and there's no shame in being a striker in the Spanish Primera Liga. It's a good league to be playing in, and he's doing really well. How old is he?
He's coming up. I think he turns 30 later this year.
Yeah.
But that's a good point you make. I mean, he is a big game player, and you know, United are very good at spotting that type. He's a big game player for his country. He scores in big, crucial games for Angola, and his highlight certainly of this season has been a couple of goals against Real Madrid, in which a game with Valladolid, I think we're ahead a couple of times,
yeah.
And they were typical Manucho goals, big guy, set piece, bullying Sergio Ramos. That's what he does when it goes well for him. But you know, as you say, overall he picks his moments, rather, and they're a bit too far apart in club football for him to be regarded as a great African player, an Eto'o or a Drogba. But in the Angolan context, that's what he is.
Bebe was a big fee signing, if not a big name signing, for Manchester United. He's Portuguese, but his background is from Cape Verde. So in theory, he could play in the Africa Cup of Nations for Cape Verde. What did you make of the whole Bebe transfer and of his future, because he's now playing in the Portuguese top flight and he's doing okay. He's not at one of the big three clubs, but he's in the top flight and he's doing okay.
Yeah, it's interesting. His name has cropped up around this Africa Cup of Nations, sort of vaguely, because Cape Verde are the romantic story of this Cup of Nations. It's a tiny group of islands in the Atlantic. This is the first Africa Cup of Nations they're qualified for. They drew against South Africa in their opening game, their first ever big tournament game, and we're beginning to discover a bit more about the football culture there. And the football culture there is mainly to do with exports. Nani is a Cape Verdean. He was born there. There are a couple of other players in the current Portuguese setup who are Cape Verdeans. Generally, if you're a good Cape Verdean footballer, you've played for Portugal. Or if your parents ended up emigrating somewhere else in France or whatever. Patrick Vieira, actually, his grandmother was Cape Verdean. Anyway, Bebe, who... Yes, has an interesting history in many ways. There was a tentative approach to Bebe from the Cape Verdean Federation to see if he might be interested in playing for them. He's eligible because of his background. They didn't get an entirely positive response because he wanted to concentrate on getting his club career going, which, as you know, has been difficult. And I think he still thinks that he might have an international future with Portugal. Now, I guess any United fan who saw Bebe might think, what? How is he going to get into the team of Cristiano Ronaldo, Nani, and so on? But recently, as you say, for Rio Ave, where he's ended up, top flight, middle-ranking top flight in Portugal, he's put in a couple of good performances recently. And in Portugal, people are saying, well, maybe this whole mystery about Bebe, the huge fee to United, the apparent, well, should we say, rawness that made that fee look odd. Maybe these are just stages. Maybe he's got something. Maybe he will come good.
What do you think went on there? Because there is mystery to it, but Ferguson's not a muck. He's not absolutely stupid. He admitted that he'd never seen the player before, but he took advice off people he trusted before sanctioning United to sign him for a huge fee. But it stinks in the eyes of many United fans. They can't prove anything's gone wrong, but it stinks.
Yes, I mean it looks bad, and it's one of those transfers that when you assess a managerial reign, is going to be held as a black mark. You know, in his long time in charge, Alex Ferguson has bought some duds, but he's also bought a much greater number of good players. I think we know that United have strong connections in Portugal, in the Portuguese-speaking world. I think we know that there's a fairly efficient and successful set of player brokers acting out of Portugal. I think there are times when, as a manager, you act on instinct, you trust your sources, you trust people who've provided for you in the past. Sometimes you make mistakes. Whether or not anybody's especially beholden to anybody else in the complicated area of transfers when you're dealing with people you've dealt with a long time before is, of course, entirely speculative. It was very odd. It was very odd, the series of moves that had to be made, Bebe moving between three clubs in a very short period of time, his fee rocketing up in a short period of time. It's one of those mysteries that I suspect will take a very, very long time to unravel, if ever it is.
Manchester United have got a good scouting network, as you know. You've lived in South Africa in the past. United are very popular in South Africa. You've covered United on pre-season tours there, and United have been back several times since. The club like it because the facilities are good. There's no jet lag when United go there. The stadiums are huge, the crowds are huge, and breweries tend to sponsor games, which gives United big match fees. United had a link-up club several years ago in Cape Town called FC Fortune. It was nowhere near as successful as Ajax Amsterdam's link up with Ajax Cape Town. Did you know anything about FC Fortune, apart from the fact that Fortune comes from Quinton's name?
Only a little bit, and that, as you say, it started off as a, I wouldn't say a big idea, but a substantial idea at a time when there was quite a fashion for feeder clubs in Africa. Ajax Amsterdam set up the model and did very well in terms of fairly high profile players. Benny McCarthy came through there. Stephen Pienaar came through those structures. Lesser known, Aaron McQuenna, formerly of Blackburn, came through there. And actually, there's quite an exciting player, Tulani Serrero, now at Ajax Amsterdam, who came through that system.
McQuenna was McQuenna, to be fair to him, was good enough to be captain of his country in, as they hosted the World Cup.
Yeah, absolutely. Yes, and he was a good, and I hope you'll forgive the cliche, he was a good no nonsense defender. He was, interestingly, he's on the television here as a pundit for the Africa Cup of Nations. Some South Africans think he still should be in the national team.
Is he still known as the Axe?
Very much so. Very much so. Yes. Yeah. He's Aaron has always had a tackle on him, I think.
when he arrived in Manchester, which is where a lot of the Blackburn players lived, well, the first thing he did was arrange for my brother to be his driver, because he wasn't allowed to drive in the UK. So my brother used to drive him up to Blackburn's training ground at Brockenhall every morning, and they struck up an unlikely friendship when they became good mates. So suddenly our kid, who's a plumber in Manchester, was mates with this lad who was a captain of South Africa and liked buying white suits.
Yeah, listen, Andy, I've met your brother, and I know his capacity to be popular with absolutely everybody. I'm sure they would have had a good time together. And Aaron's a good guy. He's good company. He's jovial on a night out. I think he'll forgive us for saying that.
And you covered United in '93 for the Manchester Evening News. Is that right? You're a Cub reporter, and you were filing when Manchester United went there, when the players met Nelson Mandela. People like Brian Robson and Steve Bruce were over there, and they loved that tour. Those players.
Thanks for reminding me. I did as well. You're right. I was a Cub reporter, and I contacted the Manchester Evening News and asked if they'd like me to cover the tour for them, and they said yes. And actually, it turned out to be very eventful. I expect a few people remember this. They played against Arsenal in Ellis Park.
Yeah.
Which was then really the headquarters of rugby in South Africa. So this was quite a high-profile friendly. It was broadcast in England. We're talking about the early 90s here, so it wasn't the days when every kick of a football was on television somewhere. And Brian Robson was sent off. Now, by a referee who was quite notorious in South Africa, Errol, the Hanging Judge Sweeney, as he was known. And so they were pretty cross about this. Okay, it was Arsenal, and again, early 90s, big rivals, but it was a pre-season friendly, more than an exhibition game, but a friendly, and there was this referee who suddenly became the centre of attention. So, United were a bit cross about this, but I must say, they evidently liked it here. I remember Alex Ferguson telling me that he thought this was a real long-term project, partly because of the altitude. They're in Johannesburg, and it's very high up, and that's very good for stamina training, pre-season preparation. He liked that. And they were very, very good at PR. Now, this might surprise people. Again, we're talking 20 years ago. They were very, very good about presenting themselves, being available to the people of a country which at that stage was quite fragile politically. It was before the elections that brought Nelson Mandela to the presidency. United went into townships. They did very, very genuine coaching sessions. And what was striking is that they were so much better at that aspect of it than Arsenal were. Arsenal were in their hotel complaining about being here, complaining about facilities all the time. So that's how it was, but it was great fun to cover, and I must say the manager was extremely helpful to this Cub reporter from the Manchester Evening News.
you talked about the hanging judge. There's some great names in African football. You've covered some of them in your book. What are your favourites?
I was always quite a fan in South Africa of Thomas Who's Fooling Who Hlongwane.
Where do these names come from?
from fans. Thomas Hlongwane was a great dribbler. He had a few tricks, and so I think at the time, actually, when he was at his peak, there was possibly an Aretha Franklin, I'll be corrected on this, an Aretha Franklin song or album which was popular at the time, which included the phrase "Who's Fooling Who."
It's "Who's Zooming Who?" Zooming.
That's right. Sorry. Yeah. Perhaps that. Thank you, Andy. Popular culture. You always trump me.
And which give us some other players' names. I love hearing them because they're so ridiculous.
There was a South African player for some reason, and we're going back a few years back now. He was known as Baboon Shepherd. Now that's not really a job description, as far as I know. And I've been mystified about how that nickname came over. Something interesting happened last night, actually, at the Ivory Coast Togo match, which I was at here in Rustenburg.
Yeah.
You may remember a player, Didier Zokora, who was with Tottenham for a while. He's been around various European clubs. You'll remember him being quite successful at Sevilla.
Yeah.
Now, he has always, since he was a child, had the nickname Maestro. Yesterday, he took the field with the word Maestro on the back of his shirt. Now, it's a pretty big claim, isn't it, to be Maestro? And I think he got a bit of stick from international commentators for this, because it looks like you're going out saying I'm the big guy here, I'm the main guy here. But actually, to be fair to him, he's been known as Maestro by his friends since he was about 13 years old, growing up in the football academy in Abidjan. So he just did the Brazilian thing, basically. He put his nickname on the back of his shirt. I'm just trying to think. I'd be surprised to see anything like Who's Fooling Who on the back of a shirt, but maybe one day.
I love the fans in South Africa. I went to cover the Orlando Pirates-Kaizer Chiefs game a few years ago. It was the biggest game in the country by a mile. And they played one league match in Port Elizabeth, away from Soweto, where both teams are from. And I was just about to walk from my hotel because United were playing in South Africa at the time. And the receptionist said, "Where are you going?" I said, "Well, I'm walking to the stadium to watch the match." And she looked at me like I was crazy. She said, no, it's dangerous for a white man to walk to that stadium now. And I said, well, I'm walking anyway. And I walked there, and it was absolutely fine. The crowd was about 30,000 people in Port Elizabeth. The only other white person I saw was on the pitch. But everyone was great with me. And why shouldn't they be? There were a couple of white police officers as well. It was a bit chaotic outside the stadium, and I was thinking there could be issues here ahead of the World Cup. But it's a big rivalry, and the World Cup seems to have been a success in South Africa.
The World Cup was a huge success for the country as a whole, because I think there was quite a lot of scepticism from elsewhere because of the crime problems here, and an idea that in Africa, things are harder to organise. It was brilliantly organised. It was hugely popular. There were very, very few instances of serious crime related to the tournament. And I think all spectators and fans felt very welcome. Quite what the legacy of that World Cup is in terms of what it's done for the country's football and what it's done in terms of a return on the investment, the huge investment that was made in stadiums and infrastructure, that's pretty moot. There are stadiums here which are certainly not used enough, stadiums that were built or refurbished specifically for the World Cup. These things are very expensive. Olympics and World Cups are very expensive. And in a recession time, it's much harder to justify the public money that goes into them.
I saw Danny Jordan, one of the organisers of the World Cup, in a speech. He did a speech last month, and he was claiming that even though the financial cost was high, the country would do it all again, given the chance in terms of the international perception, A couple of regrets. He said that the average cost of flying to South Africa for the World Cup had doubled and there's nothing they could do to control that. But all in all, it was very positive. You're in South Africa now for the tournament, but you're actually a Fulham fan, and Manchester United are playing Fulham twice over the next couple of weeks. The first game's at the weekend in the FA Cup, and then United are playing at Craven Cottage in a couple of weeks. How are you finding Fulham this season, and how's Dimitar Berbatov doing?
Well, those two questions are obviously closely related. Fulham, at times this season, have been very nice to watch, and the overall feelings, sort of, until about November, were pretty positive. We're like all fans, we're pretty intolerent of managers and so on, but for me, Martin Jol has had slightly too much criticism from a group of Fulham fans. I think he's been trying to do the right thing, and I think some of his signings have been pretty good. But at the top of the list of those is Berbatov. By the way, I'm always told by Bulgarians that his name is Berbatov.
Yeah, I stand corrected on that. I've been told that by Bulgarians, and he's doing well.
Yeah, but I think if you and I launched a campaign to have him renamed Berbatov in the English media, we wouldn't get very far, would we?
No, we'd so look let's like call him Berbatov, we'd look like Ponzi journalists.
Exactly. Yeah. He has done mainly very well, and Joel has made him a figurehead, a leader of the team, and he seems to be thriving on that. He's scored some very good goals. He's scored some important goals. He's won some matches. When he plays well, he is a joy to watch. And he also seems to be happy. You know, he seems to be enjoying himself. I think there was a bit of a, well, there had to be a reasonably hard sell to get him to come to Fulham. And there was, as you'll remember, there was a bit of brinkmanship at the end of the transfer window involving Fiorentina. Listen, we like him so far. We like him. And as the sharp point of a team that potentially can play pretty nice football when you've got Brian Ruiz and so on, it's positive having him there. You have to remember that two pretty popular players left, Dembele and Dempsey. So I think there needed to be a charismatic signing, and so far Berbatov has been that.
Can you get that bird to shut up behind you?
You're talking about the feathered variety. Oi, love, shut up.
You said that he's popular. He's still very popular among a lot of Manchester United fans. I think the reason United got rid of him is because they looked at his stats in big, big matches and said that he wasn't doing enough. And he may have scored a hat-trick against Liverpool at home, but that wasn't classed as one of United's biggest games. And I think what did for him was when he missed two chances in the 2011 FA Cup semi-final at Wembley against Manchester City. And when he wasn't even on the bench in the European Cup final a month later, people saw that as the beginning of the end for him, and that proved to be the case. I went to Munich recently to interview one of his former teammates, Hans-Georg Butt, the former Bayern Munich goalkeeper. But he played with Berbatov, Dimitar, whatever we're going to call him, at Leverkusen when they reached the Champions League final in 2002. And he said he was supremely talented, but very lazy. And he also said he trained with him every day for 3 or 4 years and probably only spoke to him 3 or 4 times. He said he was a very shy person, hugely talented, but he felt he could have gone on to do better if he wouldn't have been so lazy. So I thought that was an interesting perspective from somebody who's played with him. You mentioned Dembele. Fulham were really good at Old Trafford earlier on this season, which surprised me because Fulham's record at Old Trafford is atrocious. It's almost Wigan-esque.
Yeah, yes, that's. I mean, Dembele is, I think, a really, really talented player, and possibly contributed more to Fulham certainly in the last whatever it was 18, the last 18 months of that, than Dempsey did, in spite of Dempsey's knack of scoring important goals.
Well, are you trying to rub this in here after what happened at the weekend? Do you know what happened? Of course you will see the results.
Know what happened, yeah. Listen, I'm a great admirer of Dempsey, but you know what he does for another club, I'm afraid, doesn't move me one way or the other anymore. I'm like that as a fan. You know, when Fulham play well, they can keep the ball well and cause problems to anybody, as they say. One of the big moments for any Fulham supporter of the last whatever 20 years was our first game back in the Premier League, where again we caused Manchester United some problems. If you remember Old Trafford.
Yeah, I remember it well. Sahar was playing, wasn't he?
He was playing, yes.
And what's been your highlight as a Fulham fan? You played in a European final in Hamburg a couple of seasons ago. Had I said to you at the start of the 1990s, when you were getting 4,000 people and people like Andy Cole and Paul Parker were on loan and wanted to get out of Craven Cottage as soon as they could, that within 2 decades you'd be playing in a European Cup final, would you believe that?
Absolutely no way. I mean, it's less than 20 years ago that we were watching Fulham playing not to go to position 92 in what was then the Football League, i.e., you know, one off the bottom. There were some awful times in the 90s, really awful. Some interesting away trips with plenty of time to contemplate defeats on the coach on the way back. It's been an extraordinary rise. Pretty much without precedent, actually, if you think about the circumstances. And okay, you have clubs like Wigan who have also come up a very long way in a similar period of time, but not with, you know, not with the owner of Harrods in charge with his eccentric ways. It's very difficult to be a Fulham fan and not be very grateful to Mohamed Al-Fayed, whatever you think about him, and whatever you think about his motives. When he first took over, we assumed that there was some ulterior motive to do with a very valuable site and property in West London. That's not materialised, you know, the taking advantage of that, at least at this stage. But I guess my highlight, it would have to be the Europa League final in Hamburg. It really was a, you know, pinch me, is this Fulham in a European final? And you know what? We did remarkably well. Atletico Madrid was so much better than Fulham. We have to acknowledge that, and we took it to extra time.
Well, they were a good side. I went caught up with Mr. Forlan a couple of weeks ago in Porto Alegre. He's doing well.
Oh, yes. How's he enjoying Brazilian football?
He's great, and he gave me a really good interview, because when he was at Old Trafford, he was very nicey-nicey, but he didn't really say so much. But I find that when players go beyond 30, they become more interesting and they can look back at more events in their career. And he was excellent. He was really, really good value, and I had a good hour speaking to him at the team hotel. He's playing for Inter in Porto Alegre, who are a huge club. They were world champions only five or six years ago, and they get big crowds, and he's on good money. He said to me that they matched his wages, what he was on at Inter Milan. So that shows how Brazil are becoming an increasing football power financially. They've always produced footballers, but they've always lost them, and now they're able to buy back some pretty big names. Not the biggest names, they'll continue to lose them. But yeah, he's happy and still going out with supermodels and enjoying life, as you would if you were Diego Forlan. You mentioned Craven Cottage and Al-Fayed. I found it really strange when a statue of Michael Jackson went up outside Craven Cottage. I know you think it's a great idea and you go there and pay your respects every week, but what was all that about?
Listen, Andy, you clearly don't understand, but if Fulham needed a second statue at the ground, he was so obviously the perfect candidate. No, it's totally weird. It's totally eccentric. Now, and it's odd. To be honest, I don't take enormous offence to it, like some Fulham fans did. There are a lot of people we would have preferred to see a statue of, clearly. But there's the thing about Fulham. There's a word which I think started in the 1960s called Fulhamish. Okay, and it's used by Fulham fans to describe something that is just, it's hard to put your finger on. It's just a little bit oddball, and you shrug about it. Fulham's historic capacity to get themselves into scrapes and on the field and off the field. The Michael Jackson statue is simply Fulhamish. It's just an eccentricity, and you know you live with it now. You go and get your coffee, you buy a burger, and there's not a very good replica of Michael Jackson.
We've had a letter about it to United We Stand this month. It's saying it's similar to the one at Southampton, which they had to destroy. So he's obviously not a fan. But a lot of United fans like Fulham away. They like Craven Cottage. There's some really nice pubs near the ground, even though it's difficult to get to with the traffic and it being in London. And far from selling it off and converting the prime location by the Thames into apartments, you're actually building another tier on the stand by the side of the river. So that will boost the capacity up above 30,000. Fulham are selling out most weeks, basically established as a Premier League club now.
Yes. I mean, I hope so. And, you know, you always, as a Fulham fan, start with the fear of relegation, and that on one occasion took us right into the middle of May. But yes, there is a certain stability and there's a certain ambition. And you're right that you know that they do sell out most weeks. You have to acknowledge that there's a section of those tickets that for lower key games certainly go to, I think tourists is probably the best word for it, people who happen to be in London who want to see some football, and that's a nice London venue to go and see it. Mm. But yeah, you know, there's as you know, Premier League stability is quite cumulative, and it's more than a decade now, and touch wood, they seem to have got the momentum and know how to succeed in the Premier League.
We're running out of time now. I've enjoyed speaking to you. I'm going to ask you for some predictions. First of all, in the FA Cup game at Old Trafford, and secondly, in the league game at Craven Cottage.
Fulham will say goodbye to the FA Cup at this stage of the tournament. But you know, we're not very... Our FA Cup record overall is pretty rubbish. We're in the final once, as you know, generations ago in 1975. But overall, it's not really our competition. We'll go out of that, I'm afraid. But I think we'll get a point off you in the league.
I don't think a point would be a terrible result for United. I remember going there a couple of years ago, December. Got beat 3-0. Michael Carrick at centre-half because there was a huge injury list. It was -3, and I thought that day, you know what, I don't quite like coming to Craven Cottage as much as it used to do. So I don't think a point would be terrible for United, but I think we'll beat you twice. How's that for arrogance, cocksure arrogance of a Manchester United fan?
Well, no, I'm glad you remember that victory in the cold, because in cold weather, which I understand you're having quite a bit of in England... we find as Londoners that when Northerners come down and the weather's a bit cold, they simply wilt. They can't handle it.
Thanks for your time, Ian. Enjoy the rest of the Africa Cup of Nations. Who do you think's going to win it?
Ivory Coast are the favourites for fairly obvious reasons of personnel. I saw them play not very well yesterday.
How did Yaya Touré do?
Yaya Touré is one of their better players.
Jovinho?
Jovinho was excellent. You'll be astonished to hear this. Jovinho was excellent. Now, I've just told you they played badly. Those two played well. Nobody else did. Didier Drogba was really, really woeful. I think Ghana might win it.
Well, let's see how it all goes. And hopefully we'll speak to you again, Ian.
OK, cheers, Andy. Nice to talk to you.
So that's it for this episode of United We Stand. We'll be back next week. We're starting work on the next issue of the Mag, which comes out against Everton in a couple of weeks. We've also got a new writer on uwsonline.com who's very good. He goes to every single United game, home and away, and makes observations, the type of things that Sky TV don't cover, whether it's what's going on underneath the stands or on the way to the game, that type of stuff. So he's worth checking out. Until next week, goodbye.